Podcasting from the beautiful San Francisco Bay Area in California, this is Venus Rising, where we discuss all things related to big fertility and encourage you to think beyond the masses. I'm Jennifer Law, your host, joined by Cicely Marie, my co-host and producer, bringing you the best and most up-to-date conversations on fertility, infertility, and women's reproductive health. Welcome to Venus Rising, where Cicely Marie and I have a very special guest with us here today, Callie Pfau. Callie serves as our research assistant here at the Center for Bioethics and Culture, but by day she's a busy labor and delivery nurse at a major university hospital out here in the Bay Area. Before going back to school, Callie worked as a scientist in the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology at Vanderbilt University. She has her master's degree in reproductive physiology and did research in endometriosis and preterm birth. Callie is very passionate about women's health, and I'm sure you'll pick up on that as we get chatting with her today. Welcome to Venus Rising, Callie.
Thank you guys so much. I'm so excited to be here. You guys are super badass, and I'm just happy to be here.
Well, it's really good
to have you here. We're very happy to have you here.
And we enjoy working with you. So, Callie, you know, it's really mind-boggling to me. I see this over and over again in all of my travels, especially when I'm showing one of our films, like Exploitation. I'm always struck by how little women seem to know about their own reproductive bodies, especially given how fragile human reproduction is. Would you agree with that in your assessment of the workings that you see every day with women? And maybe you can just break down the basics for our listeners. I think that'd be very helpful for them.
For sure. You know, endocrinology and reproduction are they're kind of married systems. They go together, and they're very complex topics. There's a lot that even scientists don't know and understand, but I would absolutely agree with you that women and men seem to be very uninformed when it comes to their own reproductive systems. In my job, I have to laugh because I found that one of the most common misconceptions that women and men have about female anatomy is the difference between the urethra and the vagina. I'm here to tell everyone that they are not the same thing. Women have two different openings down there. As a labor and delivery nurse, I assist a woman decide that they want an epidural. And once they have an epidural, she can't get up to walk around. So most of the time we insert a catheter into the urethra. As I'm explaining what I'm doing, I've had dozens of patients and their partners ask about how that catheter is going to affect the delivery of their baby. Of course, we remove that catheter once the patient starts pushing, but this is completely irrelevant since they are, in fact, two different openings leading to two different places. To give you a kind of context of the woman's body, the urethra opening leads to the bladder where your urine is stored, and the vagina leads to the uterus. In all, the external part of a woman's reproductive system is called the vulva. And the vulva includes the mons pubis, the labia, the clitoris, and the perineum. The labia are the two skin folds that surround the opening of the vagina. And the vagina itself is a muscular hollow tube that leads to the cervix, which is also kind of like the neck of the uterus. Most people, I think, that have had a baby are very aware of the term cervix. It's kind of a hot word you hear in labor and delivery. The cervix is actually very small, but during labor, it dilates so that a baby is able to pass through. To the whole reproductive system, there are two more very important parts to women's anatomy, and that's the fallopian tubes and the ovaries. The ovaries are also part of that endocrine system I talked about, and they produce, store, and release eggs into the fallopian tubes during ovulation. The fallopian tubes then connect the ovaries to the uterus so that the egg can be implanted or fertilized or passed during menstruation. It's a lot of information, and I can understand why men and women are easily confused, but fortunately, I think that our culture's changing. I think that women are becoming more comfortable talking and learning about their bodies, and that's promising.
Yeah, it's very, very important because, like you said, I think a lot of women don't know about their own reproductive systems, and we can't rely on men to obviously tell us about that. So it's good that we educate ourselves. So what are some of the things that women can do to protect and preserve their fertility? You must see a lot of things in your clinical practice and in the hospital where you can educate and advise women on what would be most helpful for us to hear.
I think I want to answer your question, but before I do, I just want to let all of our listeners know that their value is absolutely not determined by their ability to conceive children. I think we have that in our heads as women, that our value does come from being a mother, being able to conceive.
That's incredibly beautiful. I love that so, so much.
Yeah. But continuing to answer your question, studies have shown that anywhere from 5 to 15% of women have a hard time getting pregnant or staying pregnant. And there's nothing that these women could have done to prevent their infertility. For example, endometriosis, that's a condition that can cause infertility, and one of the treatments for endometriosis is birth control. So these women are kind of stuck in a catch-22, and they have a very hard time conceiving children. For women who don't have a hard time with fertility, there are things that can be done to promote or protect your fertility. The first step, I guess, is understanding. Know your menstrual cycle in your body. On average, a woman has about 5 days each month when she's fertile and can achieve pregnancy. Couples who are trying to conceive need to know that their bodies, they need to know their bodies and understand the process of conception. It's a finely orchestrated event. Secondly, practicing healthy habits, smoking, obesity, sexually transmitted diseases, excess consumption of alcohol, and high levels of stress all have negative effects on fertility. And further, women with eating disorders are also more likely to have amenorrhea or not have a menstrual cycle. And then finally, the last thing that we can do is not wait too long if you hope to have children. We can work out all we want, we can inject our faces with Botox, but our bodies will age. And as we age, our fertility dramatically decreases. And eventually women will go through menopause. Working in the Bay Area, I see many women who struggle with infertility simply because they waited too long. Women can start to have a natural decline in fertility in their mid-30s. Older women tend to have a smaller number of eggs. Her eggs aren't as healthy. And then their ovaries become less able to release eggs. Studies show that older women have a harder time maintaining the pregnancy if they do become pregnant. So all of those things can kind of, you know, help a woman promote her or protect her fertility.
Can you tell us a little bit about how age affects the eggs?
Sure. So women are born with a certain amount of eggs, not like men. Men can create and produce sperm throughout their lifetime. They are how women are born with X number of eggs. Some of those eggs die off. Some of those eggs, of course, are released through menstruation, and the amount of eggs decreases. And then once there are no more eggs, you're done. And then also, women who are older have higher incidences of genetic abnormalities. You've heard of Down syndrome being one of those, for example.
Right.
And so that's kind of what.
Okay, yeah. That makes sense.
The eggs basically aren't high quality anymore.
Right. They're aging. Right. They're aging right. With the body.
Exactly.
It's like when you go to the grocery store, do you want the expired eggs or do you want the
right, exactly. So Kelly, can you give us a little snapshot of the day in the life of a labor and delivery room nurse?
Oh, this is such a hard question. I think every labor nurse or any nurse can, you know, it's frustrating when we get this question sometimes because it's so hard because every day is so different. There's not a typical day. I kind of tell people, and I explain to my husband because he's not medical at all and is completely oblivious, I think, to the work that I do, but our birth center operates kind of like a mini hospital. So if you kind of think about it like that, it's easier to imagine. We triage patients like you would see in an emergency room. We have patients that are with us for months of monitoring or treatment. And then we, of course, have our laboring patients. And then we have operating rooms where we perform procedures and surgery. So in any role throughout my shift, I'm responsible for the life of my mama and her unborn child. Those are my two patients. So some of the tasks that I might do in a day are admitting patients, which includes the hospital paperwork, starting IVs, making sure that the family is familiar with their surroundings. And then throughout the course of labor, I check a woman's cervix. I give medications as indicated. I'm constantly monitoring fetal heart rate tracings to make sure my baby's okay. And my mama's contraction patterns to make sure that she is in labor and she stays in labor. I also monitor maternal vital signs, and I help moms with their pain management, whether that's a natural delivery and or an epidural. And then I'm communicating with the rest of the medical team. Other important roles, I do probably two most important, maybe my favorite, are educator and cheerleader. Many, many families are so anxious about the delivery process. So I'm trying to educate the family about what's happening and what might take place. And then when it comes time to push, which is absolutely my favorite part, I help mama become the warrior that she is. And I love cheering her on and coaching her through that. And then sometimes, you know, the safest way to deliver a baby is through C-section. And so in those cases, I'll help circulate in the operating room and then recover her after the surgery.
So on any given day, how many mamas are you looking after?
So fortunately, our hospital is pretty much one-on-one if a patient is in labor. But I think the most deliveries I personally was in charge of were three in a day. So wow. I've had three babies born in one day. And that was a busy day.
That is a very busy day. That's so much responsibility.
How many babies have you helped deliver? Do you keep track?
I do. I have it in my phone, and I don't keep track of names or any personal information. It's just literally a number count. And I looked at it the other day, and I think I'm at like just below 200.
Yeah. And have you done twins?
I have.
Triplets?
I've not done triplets. No. No, I've done twins.
Any natural delivery twins or all cesarean?
No, actually, I've had some natural delivery twins for sure. And then we've also had two where like one baby will be born vaginally and the other baby will be born via C-section.
Okay.
So mom gets both experiences.
Wow.
So,
yeah.
And the nurse has to do both.
Exactly.
Just so our listeners know, today we're not giving any medical advice. We're just having a nice conversation about natural, normal women reproduction. So if you have any problems or issues, we certainly refer you to seek out your personal physician. Callie, I know your research was in endometriosis and premature birth, but let's talk a little bit about some of the common conditions that cause fertility problems for women. Can you break down polycystic ovarian syndrome, PCOS, for our listeners?
Absolutely. So in order to understand PCOS, we have to kind of remember the basics again. So in order to become pregnant naturally, a woman has to produce and release an egg from her ovaries through ovulation. And then, of course, she needs to have functional fallopian tubes and cervix and uterus. But in PCOS, we're mainly talking about the ovaries and ovulation. Without ovulation, there are no eggs that can be fertilized by the sperm. Sorry. So PCOS causes problems with ovulation. It is actually the most common cause of female infertility. And what it is it's a hormonal disorder or a hormonal imbalance which interferes with normal ovulation. Women with PCOS often have higher level of androgens and lower levels of progesterone. In PCOS, a lack of progesterone contributes to irregular periods that someone with PCOS might see. Also in PCOS, the body isn't as responsive to insulin as it should be, which can lead to elevated blood glucose levels, which then causes the body to make more insulin. And then having too much insulin also causes the body to make more androgens. So you're kind of in this vicious cycle of having too much of one thing and not enough of another, and then the woman can't ovulate and become fertilized.
Yeah, and I'm probably confident that a lot of our listeners right now just aren't aware of how common PCOS actually is mm-hmm. for many, many women driving this. So let's shift then from talking about polycystic ovarian syndrome to the distinction with POI, which is primary ovarian insufficiency and menopause. Talk a little bit about that.
Sure. So POI, or primary ovarian insufficiency, is a condition when a woman is running low on her egg supply or is completely out of eggs before the age of 40. And it is not the same thing as early menopause or menopause. Menopause is the natural decline in eggs that women go through. That's not a disease. It's not infertility. POI is a medical condition. So young women who don't have enough eggs or have completely ran out. So that's kind of the distinction there.
Yeah, which I think is really important for women to know that about mm-hmm. their bodies. That we're born, like you said, with all the eggs we're ever going to have, and then they're gone. So
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
the biological clock is still real.
It is.
Yes,
it is, as much as we want to stop it, right? I know that this show is focusing solely on women, but it's important to note that men can also struggle with infertility too, and they can have their own reasons.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And then the whole category of just unknown.
Yeah.
Like, everything seems to be working fine in this couple, but for whatever reason, they just can't seem to conceive.
Exactly.
Right? So there's just nothing we've been able to find out. And really, just hearing you describe all this, it's like, it's amazing we even have babies.
I know, right?
You know, when you think of all the things that can go wrong. But, you know, we're not like rabbits, that's for sure. That's how we can reproduce. You know, when I was a nurse working in pediatrics, my kids always loved it when I came home from work at the end of the shift. And they'd say, Mom, tell us some stories. Of course, they always wanted, you know, funny stories or, you know, juicy stories or more. Without violating HIPAA here.
Right, of course.
The privacy of our patients. Tell us some of the stories that you would tell to people that say, hey, how was your day at the office today?
Yeah. Another really tough question. Because, you know, a lot of people think of labor and delivery nursing, they think it's the happiest job on earth. And it definitely is, and it definitely can be. But it's nothing short of incredible to get to see babies be born and help a family start or grow. But it's also very physically and emotionally demanding. I guess one of my favorite stories, it's not quite so happy. It's something that stayed with me because I was a young nurse. I'm still a young nurse, but in my very first few months of my career, I had the privilege of taking care of this really young couple that were having their first baby. And this sweet, sweet, sweet baby was born with a genetic abnormality that was not compatible with life. And she didn't live long after she was born. So I had this kind of interesting job of helping this family bring this girl into life and then also help them make some end of life decisions. It just really touched me, and it's something I always remember when I walk into a room. The upside of the story and the positive part of the story that I love, about a year later, a senior nurse colleague that happened to know this couple came to me and told me that this couple is pregnant again and we're hoping that I could be their nurse. And I felt so privileged, and it just reminds me every day of how important our job is and how amazing women are. So
that's
my story.
That literally brought me to tears.
That's the hard part of the job, is when you do have those kind of tragedies when it normally is supposed to be a really, really happy day. And people lose a baby that was so desperately wanted. And that's one of the things we try to do in our work. Sometimes we can see in the Center for Bioethics and Culture that we're not compassionate about those struggling with infertility or lost children because of genetic diseases or whatever, but that's just part of the ebbs and flows of life, and we always want people to be really, really, really informed about their fertility.
Before making any decisions, that's right.
Yeah.
Well, Kelly, thank you so much for being here. We love having you here. You're welcome anytime. And for all of our listeners, thank you so much for listening today and supporting Venus Rising. You guys can find us on Amazon, YouTube, and at cbc-network.org for any additional information. Please make sure to tune in next time, where we are educating and encouraging you to think beyond the masses.
Thanks for listening to Venus Rising with Jennifer and Cicely. If you like our show and want to know more, check us out at cbc-network.org. Leave us a review on iTunes too, and join us next week for another conversation on fertility, infertility, and women's reproductive health.